Audio Companion. The Full Manifesto, Part 1 of 2. Before we begin, one note about this recording. Source citations are not read aloud here. Every number in this document is traced to a public source in the written version at wethepeopleplatform.com, where you can check any of it yourself. Nothing has been removed from the argument itself, where the platform is uncertain, or where a claim still needs outside expert review. This recording says so, exactly as the written document does. This is part 1 of 2. An architecture for shared prosperity, 12 pillars. 1. Foundation. When I do well, we all do well. Jason Robertson sources baseline. The numerical claims in this document derive from published federal data, Internal Revenue Service statistics of income for filer counts and income distributions, Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services national health expenditure data for the $14,570 per capita healthcare baseline, Census Bureau population estimates for per capita denominators, and Social Security Administration trustees' reports. The platform's own combined reform model and federal fiscal impact analysis supply the sovereign fund projections and the pillar-level cost estimates. The exact citations are in the written version and are not read aloud here. 2 clarifications are worth stating out loud, because they are easy to misread. First, the $63 trillion figure is the platform's own derived estimate of cumulative, undiscounted, 60-year transition financing. It is not the Social Security Administration's 75-year actuarial deficit, which is a different measure for 0.42% of taxable payroll. Second, the claims in this document that require external credential validation are tracked openly in the platform's open issues registry. They are not presented as settled. One further note on the trajectory. More recent Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services data shows per capita health spending has since risen to $15,474, 18% of gross domestic product. That is the cost curve this reform addresses. A note before you begin, this is not a campaign document. It is not a wish list. It is the foundation of a way of thinking about how an economy can be organized to produce shared prosperity rather than concentrated prosperity. It rests on a simple proposition. When we measure honestly, contribute fairly, and direct the wealth that we collectively produce toward the things that benefit all of us, we get a country that works better for almost everyone. The mechanism by which this happens is not novel and is not theoretical. Australia has been running a version of it since 1992. Norway has been running another version since 1990. Singapore has been running a third version since 1955. Each of these countries is wealthier, healthier, and more economically secure than its peers, in part because of the architecture each has chosen. The proposition that follows applies that architecture to the United States. It is described in 3 parts because its 3 components support each other. None of them stand fully alone. Together, they make a system. The analysis underneath each part is real. There are spreadsheet models with thousands of formulas behind the numbers in this document. There are international comparisons drawn from peer-reviewed economics literature. There are honest acknowledgments of where the analysis has limits and where serious institutional analysis would be needed before any of this could become law. This document does not perform that analysis. It summarizes it. The technical detail lives in companion documents available on request. What you will find here is a vision and the structure that supports it. If the vision speaks to you, the analysis is available. If the analysis is what you want first, the white papers exist. This document is the bridge between the two. What this architecture encourages, this platform encourages 5 things at once: individuality, inclusivity, unity, equity, and ownership in America's bright future for me and my friends and my neighbors and every American. Together, individuality, because universal supports decouple personal mobility from employer dependence and free citizens to pursue their own paths in work, in learning, and in family life. A person who is not afraid of losing health coverage can change jobs. A person who is not paying down a degree's debt can take a risk on something new. A person whose long-term care is secured can plan for the life they want rather than the life their precarity dictates. Inclusivity, because the federal as-floor architecture means no group can fall below the baseline regardless of where they live or how much they earn. The architecture is universal in scope precisely so that it cannot be made conditional on the dimensions on which Americans have historically been excluded. Unity, because the same architectural logic runs through every pillar. Shared problems share solutions. The contribution mechanism is one mechanism with 12 uses. When one of us does well, we all do better. The platform's tagline, "When I do well, we all do well," is not aspirational. It is descriptive of how the architecture is structured to operate. Equity, because the platform measures honestly and contributes fairly. Wage floors are set by occupation rather than by geography, so that the same work pays the same baseline in every state. Contribution is by means rather than by mere wage, so that the largest shoulders carry proportionate weight. The high-earner architecture, graduated income surcharge, wealth tax, ensures that the platform's expansionary commitments are funded by those who have most benefited from the existing arrangement. And ownership, because the sovereign fund and the founding stake make every American a participant in the wealth the country produces. Not just a customer of the economy or a recipient of services, but a co-owner of the future the country is building. Ownership is the difference between a citizen and a beneficiary. The platform is built to make every American the former. These five together are what this document and the 11 that follow it describe. The architecture is the means, this is the end. Where we are, the country is rich. The country is also full of people who do not feel the benefits of that wealth. Both of these things are true at the same time, and the gap between them is the problem this document addresses. Aggregate United States gross domestic product per person ranks among the highest in the world. United States median household wealth ranks near the bottom of the developed world. Aggregate United States stock market capitalization is larger than the next 9 countries combined. The percentage of Americans who report living paycheck to paycheck has not meaningfully declined in 20 years. American workers produce more output per hour than workers in almost any other country. American workers receive a smaller share of what they produce than workers in almost any other country. The gap between the wealth that the country produces and the security that ordinary people experience has many causes, and the debate about causes is a familiar one. This document is not about causes. It is about structure. The structure of how a country shares the wealth it produces is something that can be designed. The United States has chosen one design. Other countries have chosen others. The results are visible. 3 specific problems, 3 failures of the current structure are visible enough that they unite people across political coalitions when described concretely. First, retirement security is collapsing. Social Security will be unable to pay full scheduled benefits beginning in 2032. The median American household approaches retirement with savings that will fund roughly 6 years of post-retirement living. The number of Americans relying on Social Security as their primary income source in retirement is rising, not falling. Whatever we are doing now is not working. Second, wages have separated from productivity. Worker productivity has roughly doubled since 1980. Real wages for the bottom half of earners have grown by roughly 20% over the same period. The gap is the share of productivity gains that flowed to capital rather than to labor. The federal minimum wage has not been adjusted since 2009 and has lost roughly 30% of its real value. Whatever floor we have established is too low and too rigid. Third, education has become a financial trap. American students hold roughly $1.7 trillion in education debt. Student debt grows 3 times faster than wages. The average graduate spends a meaningful portion of their working career servicing it. We have created a system where the path to economic opportunity itself produces the next generation's economic insecurity. The intergenerational dynamic, a pattern has set in across American political discourse. Each generation blames the previous for the conditions they inherit. Boomers blame the New Deal generation for changing the rules. Gen X blames boomers for housing prices. Millennials blame Gen X for student debt. Gen Z blames millennials for the climate. The blame travels in every direction, and the blamers are always partially right and never fully right. What the pattern actually does is make every generation feel like a victim of the previous one, and like there's no point investing in the next one, because they'll just turn around and resent you anyway. This platform proposes a different orientation. Each generation should be positioned to help the next, not to relitigate the previous one. That is not a sentimental ask. It is a structural one. When the architecture is multi-generational by design, when the sovereign fund pays out across 60 years, when education investments compound over working lifetimes, when wage floors are indexed to be sustainable for the workforce that will exist in 2050. Every generation has a concrete reason to invest in the one coming next. The long-term goal becomes the thing everyone is working toward together, not the thing each generation argues the others have ruined. The American tradition has precedent for this kind of multi-generational design. Social Security was deliberately structured so that current workers fund current retirees, knowing the next generation will fund theirs. The New Deal more broadly understood that federal-level reform works when it is coalition across domains and across time. This platform stands in that tradition. Universalism without means testing, federal scale, not state-by-state patchwork, multi-pillar, not single policy, designed for the long horizon, not the next election cycle. The foundation. Three problems share a single underlying solution. Before describing the three structural pillars, the foundation that supports them is worth naming, because the foundation is what makes the architecture work. Pooled contribution money grows when it is invested over long horizons. This is the most powerful force in economics, and it is one of the most underused tools in American public policy. A small contribution made by every person, every year, accumulated into a single pooled fund, invested over decades, produces wealth at a scale that almost no other mechanism can match. Australia's superannuation system has accumulated roughly $4 trillion in collective worker savings since 1992. Norway's sovereign wealth fund holds roughly $2.2 trillion, 2025, equivalent to roughly 330% of Norway's gross domestic product, accumulated from energy revenues that the United States generated more of and saved less of. The American system relies on individuals to save individually, with individual outcomes that depend on individual judgment, individual luck, and individual access to financial institutions. The result is a country where most people enter retirement with inadequate savings despite living in the wealthiest country in human history. A pooled approach does not replace individual savings. It supplements them with a collective baseline that everyone has access to and that nobody has to construct alone. Empirical anchoring, most policy debates fail because they are debates about values that are described in the language of facts. What should the minimum wage be is a values debate dressed in the language of economics. What is the 25th percentile of actual wages currently paid for Occupation X is a question that the Bureau of Labor Statistics already answers every quarter. Anchoring policy decisions to data that the federal government already collects produces policy that is harder to attack as ideological and easier to defend as measured. The platform described in this document anchors three different decisions to existing federal data. It sets wage floors based on actual wage distributions. It routes education funding based on actual labor market demand. And it sets education prices based on actual cost of delivery. In each case, the data exists. The proposal is to use it. Transparency by design, the third element, is the simplest and the most important. Every funding mechanism, every decision rule, and every disbursement is publicly visible. Norway publishes the holdings of its sovereign wealth fund every quarter. Every taxpayer can see exactly what the fund owns and what it has earned. The fund cannot be quietly redirected toward political purposes because it cannot be quietly anything. Transparency is not a procedural nicety. It is a structural defense against the corruption that has degraded similar institutions in other places. The realistic path to enactment, the political conditions for federal-scale structural reform are not currently present. Congressional majorities are narrow and short-lived. The legislative supermajority required to override partisan procedural objections, 60 Senate votes for most major legislation, has been assembled briefly only a handful of times since 1980, and not held long enough to pass anything resembling the architecture this platform proposes. Public attention to policy substance, as opposed to policy as identity signal, is shallow and easily redirected. The political class that would have to enact the architecture has limited incentive to do so. The universalism that makes the architecture durable also removes the differentiating program creation that legislators trade for re-election. None of this is encouraging. It is also not the relevant question. The relevant question is whether the architecture is ready for whatever political opening eventually appears. Federal-scale reform happens during specific windows, depression, war, civil rights crisis, economic dislocation severe enough to dissolve the usual coalitions. Those windows arrive irregularly and close quickly. The 1932 election produced the New Deal because Roosevelt arrived with detailed plans that could be enacted within his first 100 days. The 1944 GI Bill was drafted with concrete provisions before the political momentum to pass it existed. The 1964 Civil Rights Act drew on a decade of legal and legislative groundwork preceding its passage. In each case, the architecture preceded the moment. This platform is an attempt at that kind of preparation. It is structurally complete enough to be drawn from, parameter by anyone in a future position to act. The funding architecture is specified. The interaction with existing programs is documented. The implementation timeline is laid out. Where credentialed external review is needed, 29 items currently tracked. Those gaps are explicit and recruitment for that review is in process. The platform's value is not contingent on near-term enactment. Its value is being ready, fully specified, and honestly anchored when a window opens. The honest answer to why now is this: because building a serious architecture takes years, the window may not be near, and being ready early matters more than being ready on time. Pillar 1. The Community Contribution Plan. The first pillar replaces the trajectory of Social Security with a hybrid system that honors every commitment to current and near-term retirees while building, in parallel, a structure that can sustain American retirement for generations. Historical precedent: Social Security and sovereign wealth funds. The architectural logic underlying the Community Contribution Plan has direct precedent in the Social Security Act of 1935, the foundational federal contribution-based social insurance program in American history. Social Security has operated continuously for 90 years on a payroll contribution model, pays benefits to over 65 million Americans annually, and represents the largest federally administered transfer program in human history. The program's structural commitment that workers contribute during earning years and receive benefits during retirement years through a federally administered pool is the architectural pattern Pillar 1 extends and modernizes. Sovereign wealth precedent comes from the Alaska Permanent Fund, established 1976, currently approximately $80 billion in assets, paying annual dividends to every Alaska resident from oil revenue returns, and the Norwegian Government Pension Fund, currently approximately $2.2 trillion in assets, 2025, the world's largest sovereign wealth fund, funding Norway's social welfare commitments from petroleum revenue returns. The Community Contribution Plan synthesizes these two architectures, the contribution-funded payout structure of Social Security with the asset accumulation and returns funding model of the Alaska and Norway sovereign wealth precedents, where Social Security relies entirely on current worker contributions to fund current retiree benefits, making it structurally vulnerable to the demographic shift the program now faces. The Community Contribution Plan adds sovereign fund returns as a permanent supplement, decoupling benefit sustainability from worker-to-retiree ratio. The platform stands on a 90-year American contribution-based social insurance tradition while extending it with the sovereign wealth architecture that has proven durable in Alaska and Norway. What it does, the current Social Security system phases out over a period long enough that no current beneficiary loses anything. Workers within 10 years of retirement remain in the existing system and receive every dollar they have been promised. Younger workers transition to a new system over 50 years, with the transition managed by a sovereign investment fund that accumulates capital from the new system's contributions and uses its returns to honor the old system's remaining obligations. The new system itself is straightforward. Employers and employees jointly contribute 12% of wages, the same combined level as the current FICA contribution, with a small increase to fund the sovereign component. 80% of the contribution flows into individual retirement accounts that workers own and can pass on to their families. 20% flows into the sovereign fund, which invests in passive index instruments under a charter modeled on Norway's, with statutory firewalls against political direction of investment decisions. What the math shows, a standalone phase-out of Social Security with no replacement system requires roughly $63 trillion in cumulative, undiscounted transition borrowing over 60 years. The math is straightforward. the system continues to owe benefits to grandfathered retirees while losing the contributions of younger workers, and the gap has to be borrowed. The combined reform produces a different result. The sovereign fund's returns offset the legacy system's deficit. Peak transition borrowing falls from $63 trillion in cumulative transition borrowing to approximately $82 billion. The reduction is 99.9%. A representative new entrant to the workforce, a 25-year-old earning $50,000, retires at age 67 with a personal retirement account that, unlike Social Security, is owned outright, inheritable, portable across jobs, and immune to trust fund insolvency. These structural advantages do not depend on any return assumption. The account's dollar value does. Under the optimistic 6% scenario, it reaches approximately $1.23 million, generating roughly $49,000 in annual retirement income, about 40% more than the current Social Security average benefit. At the sourced 4.28% baseline, it is materially lower, closer to parity with the current benefit, with the exact multiple pending the individual account calibration tract as an open issue in the platform's open issues registry. The sovereign fund itself accumulates to approximately $122 trillion per combined reform model with 6% real return compounding over 60 years, over 60 years under conservative assumptions. This number is large enough to be worth pausing over. It represents a level of national wealth held in a transparent, professionally managed, politically insulated structure that the United States has never previously constructed. This is the optimistic 6% scenario. At the sourced 4.28% baseline, the 60-year corpus is approximately $62.5 trillion. Why it works? The combination works because the two have solve each other's problems. The phase-out alone cannot work because pay-as-you-go obligations cannot be unwound without replacement revenue. The new contribution system alone takes too long to mature to meet near-term obligations. Run together, the new system's growing fund directly subsidizes the old system's shrinking deficit. By the time the old system has fully wound down, the new system has matured into something that produces retirement security at a scale the old system never approached. Pillar 2. Empirical wage floors. The second pillar replaces the single national minimum wage with a system of role-specific wage floors derived from actual wage data, indexed to inflation, calibrated to real labor markets, and structured to support the people who do the work. Historical precedent, the Fair Labor Standards Act and the Davis-Bacon Act. The architectural logic underlying empirical wage floors has direct American precedent in the Fair Labor Standards Act of 1938. Which established the federal minimum wage and the 40-hour workweek, and the Davis-Bacon Act of 1931, which established occupation-specific and locality-specific prevailing wages for federally funded construction contracts. The Fair Labor Standards Act has set a national wage floor for 88 years. The Davis-Bacon Act has demonstrated for 95 years that the federal government can determine and enforce occupation-specific, locality-specific wage requirements at scale, currently administered for approximately 30,000 federal construction projects annually with wage data published by the Department of Labor. The combination of these two architectures, a federal minimum wage floor plus occupation-specific and locality-specific wage data administered by federal agencies, is the architectural pattern Pillar 2 extends to all jobs. Empirical wage floors universalizes the Davis-Bacon architecture beyond federal contracts to the entire American workforce, replacing the single number Fair Labor Standards Act minimum with the same Bureau of Labor Statistics occupational data that already underlies prevailing wage determinations. The mechanism Pillar 2 requires federal collection of occupation codes during tax filing, wage data publication, and floor enforcement exists already in federal practice. The platform extends the existing framework rather than creating a new one. The platform stands in the joint tradition of the Fair Labor Standards Act and the Davis-Bacon Act, while universalizing their architectural logic to the entire labor market. What it does, every job in the United States has a standard occupational classification maintained by the Bureau of Labor Statistics. The system contains roughly 460 broad occupations covering essentially every kind of work that people do. The Bureau already publishes detailed wage data for each occupation every quarter, including wage distributions, geographic variation, and industry breakdowns. The data exists. This pillar adds one piece of information to the federal tax system. Every taxpayer's broad occupation, reported on Form W-2 alongside the existing wage information. With this addition, the federal government can produce wage distributions for every occupation in real time and can establish wage floors at, for example, the 25th percentile of actual wages currently paid for that occupation. The floor is set by the market itself, not by political negotiation. It binds on employers paying below the bottom quarter of their peer set in each occupation. Workers paid above the floor are unaffected. Above-floor pay flexibility for high-skill or high-performing workers is preserved entirely. Floors are recalibrated annually using a smooth 3-year moving average of wage data, capturing structural shifts in the labor market as they accumulate while damping year-to-year volatility. Because each year's recalibration incorporates the most recent wage data, nominal wage growth, including inflation, is captured automatically. No separate inflation indexing is required. What the math shows, the empirical analysis covers 81 broad occupations spanning all major occupational groups, representing approximately 82 million American workers. The 25th percentile floor varies enormously across occupations, from approximately $10 per hour for the lowest wage roles to approximately $92 per hour for the highest. The weighted average floor across the workforce works out to approximately $21 per hour, equivalent to roughly $43,000 per year. The variation itself is the point. A single national minimum wage, at any level, is the wrong tool for a labor market this differentiated. A registered nurse and a fast food worker do not have the same labor market and should not be protected by the same floor. The empirical approach produces floors that fit the actual structure of the work being done. Even the lowest 25th percentile floor in the analysis exceeds the current federal minimum wage. The market has moved, the floor has not. The proposal does not create new wage levels. It captures wage levels that already exist and applies them as floors against employers paying below the actual market. Why it works, the strongest argument for this approach is that it sidesteps the ideological debate that has paralyzed minimum wage policy for decades. Critics of higher minimum wages argue that government should not dictate wages. This proposal does not dictate wages, it observes them. The floor is set by what employers in each occupation are already paying. A critic arguing the floor is too high is arguing against the market itself, which is a much harder position to hold. The empirical literature supports the approach. The 2024 systematic review by Dubey and Zipperer of the National Bureau of Economic Research found that the median own wage elasticity of employment across studies of modest minimum wage increases is approximately -0.04, effectively zero. California's 2024 fast food minimum wage increase to $20 per hour produced no measurable employment loss, with employers passing through approximately half of higher labor costs in modestly higher prices. The economic case that 25th percentile floors produce minimal disemployment is now substantially stronger than it was a decade ago. Pillar 3, the Sovereign Education Fund. The third pillar funds higher education through a combination of birth-seeded individual accounts and disbursements from the sovereign fund at maturity, paired with a cost-based pricing framework that flags institutions charging substantially above the actual cost of delivering education. What it does? Every American newborn is enrolled in a sovereign education fund with a seed contribution of $5,000. The fund is pooled rather than individual, so that growth in years of strong returns benefits everyone in subsequent cohorts, and weak returns are absorbed by the fund as a whole rather than by unlucky individuals. The fund grows through investment returns over the 17 years before its first cohort reaches college age, accumulating approximately $400 billion before its first disbursement. At year 18, when the first cohort reaches college, the sovereign fund, the same fund that is supporting Social Security transition, begins disbursing approximately 1% of its annual balance to the education fund. This is the architectural innovation. The sovereign fund, by year 18, is large enough that even a small percentage of its balance produces substantial annual capacity for education funding. The two funds become a single connected system. The retirement engine produces the education capacity. Citizens may pursue education from age 17 through age 30. the funding window during which the Sovereign Education Fund covers tuition and required fees. The fund does not cap the number of fields, the number of credentials, or the type of program a citizen may pursue within the window. Continued funding is conditioned on academic performance. The citizen is passing the standards of the program in which they are enrolled. Specialized programs, medicine, law, engineering, sciences, carry higher per-credential costs reflecting their delivery requirements. The fund pays those higher costs without separately rationing access. Vocational and community college programs are equally valid pursuit paths. The architectural commitment is that education is welcomed and encouraged, not rationed. Cost-based pricing. The funding mechanism is paired with a cost-based pricing framework that addresses the other half of the education affordability problem. Current college sticker prices are set by what the market will bear, not by what education costs to deliver. A baseline calculation from component costs, faculty compensation, academic support, facilities, student services, and capped administrative overhead, produces a per-student per-year cost of approximately $15,000 at a regional public four-year institution. Institution-type multipliers adjust this baseline upward for legitimate cost variations. Research-intensive programs run roughly 45% more, specialized programs roughly twice the baseline. Institutions participating in the Sovereign Education Fund commit to pricing at or below the cost-based baseline calculated for their type and field of study. Pricing above the baseline is not permitted for participating institutions. The cost-based formula functions as a price ceiling for participating institutions, mechanically tied to actual delivery costs rather than to political ceilings on federal benefits. This eliminates the pricing to the maximum dynamic that has driven cost inflation in existing federal aid programs. Critically, the platform's commitment is to the student, not to the institution. Every American who pursues education receives the same baseline disbursement regardless of where they choose to attend. At a participating institution pricing at the cost-based baseline, the disbursement covers full cost. At a non-participating institution pricing above the baseline, the disbursement covers the equivalent baseline cost, and the student is responsible for any gap. The educational opportunity is universal. The institutional choice is the student's. This mirrors the architecture of the GI Bill, where veterans received fixed benefits they could carry to any accredited institution, with the institution accepting what the student brought rather than extracting more public money based on its own pricing. The cost-based formula extends to field of study granularity. A computer science program legitimately costs more to deliver than an English literature program because of equipment, faculty market wages, and lab infrastructure. The formula captures these differences using observable data, faculty market wages from Bureau of Labor Statistics occupational data, equipment and facility costs from Department of Education Integrated Post-Secondary Education Data System reporting, and standard support costs. Each component is statistically anchored to peer institutions rather than negotiated with individual institutions. Institutional cost claims above what the data shows peer institutions actually incur become visible as outliers and trigger review. Institutions remain free to spend whatever they choose internally, from endowments, research grants, or other sources, but cannot bill participating students for amounts above the formula's output. This is the structural anti-padding mechanism. The system pays only what peer institution data demonstrates education actually costs to deliver, regardless of what an individual institution chooses to charge. Disbursements flow institution to institution through the federal payment infrastructure. The student does not handle disbursement funds directly. The institution receives payment for tuition and required fees at the cost-based pricing baseline upon enrollment verification. Students may submit personal education-related expenses for reimbursement. Eligible reimbursement categories are defined explicitly in authorizing legislation and published as a structured list rather than evaluated case by case. Eligible categories include required textbooks and course materials, technology meeting specified specifications, transportation passes for commuting students, professional licensing examination fees for students completing programs requiring those examinations, and similar education direct costs with clear per category sublimits. Approval is mechanical against the published list rather than discretionary, which produces predictable rules students can plan around and removes the discretionary surface that creates both fraud opportunities and equity problems. Disbursements continue throughout the citizens' enrollment within the age 17 to 30 funding window, as long as academic performance requirements are met. What the math shows: birthseed contributions alone are insufficient to fund free college. The 18-year compound horizon, while powerful, cannot produce enough per student capital to cover full educational costs at any politically tolerable seed level. This is the honest finding of the analysis. Combined with sovereign fund disbursements at 1% of balance annually, the picture changes. By year 18, the system covers full cohort education costs. By year 60, the education fund itself has accumulated approximately $18 trillion while paying full college costs annually for every cohort. The system is not just sustainable, it is generative. Total education disbursements over 60 years exceed $15 trillion. Why it works, the combination works for the same reason the retirement combination works. The two have solved each other's problems. Birthseed funding alone cannot produce enough capital. Cost-based pricing alone does not solve the affordability problem for low-income students. Run together, they make college genuinely affordable. The funding mechanism provides the resources. The pricing framework ensures the resources are spent on actual education delivery rather than administrative growth. Honest acknowledgement: the 1% disbursement from the sovereign fund slows the retirement fund's growth. There is no free lunch in the architecture. What the architecture does is direct the wealth that compound investment produces toward shared social infrastructure rather than unbounded individual accumulation. That is a values choice, not a math trick. The math simply shows that the choice is feasible. Welcomed and encouraged, not limited, the Pillar 3 architecture has been substantially expanded in version 3.7.14 from the prior credit cap framework. Education is welcomed and encouraged, not limited. The Sovereign Education Fund no longer caps the number of fields or credentials a citizen may pursue within the age 30 funding window. Citizens may pursue one field or many, one credential or several, vocational training or doctoral study. The only constraints on continued funding are two: the student is passing the academic standards of the program they are pursuing, and they are within the age 30 window. The architectural choice not to cap pursuit is deliberate. Most citizens do not want indefinite schooling. The natural ceiling is biological and social and motivational, and the marginal population level cost of removing the cap is small. The value signal is substantial. Doctoral programs are now covered. The fund pays tuition for research doctorates and professional doctorates alike, and provides living stipends at the Pillar 2 occupation-specific wage floor for educator or researcher in training at the geographic location. This replaces the prior doctoral funding ecosystem in which research doctorates in well-funded fields rely on intense year-to-year grant scrambling. Research doctorates in underfunded fields are often only partially funded, and professional doctorates produce debt burdens that distort career choice for decades. With fund-provided tuition and stipends, federal research grants pivot to funding research itself, strengthening research capacity per grant dollar. Institutions participating in the Sovereign Education Fund must have approved curricula. The approval framework is built backwards from defined job fields. Institutions demonstrate that their curricula cover the competencies and tasks required for jobs in the field. General education content is preserved alongside field-specific competency requirements. Liberal arts paths and first-year exploration tracks are explicitly valid. Content within the competency coverage requirement remains the institution's decision, preserving academic freedom and institutional differentiation. Credit transfer follows a substance of content test. General education credits transfer universally. Field-specific credits transfer based on the documented overlap between what a course covers and what the destination field requires. Students who pivot between fields keep the credits whose content applies to the new field. They lose only credits whose content is field-specific and does not transfer. No time penalty applies to pivots within the age 30 window. When a student is struggling academically, the institution is obligated to attempt intervention. Struggling is detected through four signals: grade-based triggers, attendance-based triggers, faculty flag concerns, and student-initiated requests. The intervention pathway has four lines: academic advisor first contact, specialized resource handoff, tutoring, mental health counseling, disability services, financial counseling, case management, case manager coordination for multi-need students, and immediate crisis intervention regardless of pathway when crisis indicators appear. Intervention is offered, not imposed. Only safety risks override student declination. Records of interventions are kept separately from academic transcripts. A federal liaison is assigned to each campus participating in the Sovereign Education Fund. The liaison is federally employed, trained on the Pillar 3 architecture, and physically on campus with substantial integration into institutional operations. The liaison's role is to preserve consistency in implementation of the Pillar 3 architecture across the 4,000 or more degree-granting institutions in the United States. The model is parallel to USDA cooperative extension agents at land-grant universities, federally employed subject matter experts deeply integrated into institutional communities, serving as bidirectional channels between federal program design and local institutional implementation. The liaison's authority is primarily advisory, with specific compliance functions where consistency is essential. Pillar 3's expanded architecture is detailed in the Sovereign Education Fund substantiation document in the analytical framing folder, including cost estimates, approximately $180 to $250 billion annually at steady state, approximately 2.5% to 3.5% of sovereign fund expected returns. The counselor workforce build-out required to deliver the student support architecture and the 6 open tracked issue entries added to track. External expertise needs for the expanded design. Pillar 4, universal healthcare access. Healthcare is public infrastructure. The argument that markets allocate healthcare efficiently has been tested empirically against the experience of every other developed nation, and the results are not favorable to the market hypothesis. The United States spends more per capita on healthcare than any other country while producing health outcomes that lag most peer nations. Universal healthcare access addresses this through a German-style multi-payer architecture, regulated insurance markets with universal coverage mandates and price controls negotiated at the national level, integrated with the existing employer-based system through transition rather than displacement. Historical precedent: Medicare, the Department of Veterans Affairs, VA, the Indian Health Service, EMTALA, and the ACA. The architectural logic underlying universal healthcare access has direct American precedent in 5 large-scale federally administered healthcare programs that already cover substantial portions of the U.S. population. Medicare, established 1965, currently covering approximately 65 million Americans aged 65 and older with universal eligibility within the demographic, demonstrating that universal single-payer healthcare for a defined population works at federal scale and has operated continuously for 60 years. The Veterans Health Administration, the largest integrated health system in the United States, serving approximately 9 million enrolled veterans through 1,300 federally operated facilities. The Indian Health Service, delivering comprehensive federal healthcare to approximately 2.6 million Native Americans through 600 federally operated facilities. EMTALA, the Emergency Medical Treatment and Labor Act of 1986, requiring emergency departments to treat any patient regardless of insurance status. Federal mandate for universal emergency access since 1986, and the Affordable Care Act Medicaid expansion, 2014 present, demonstrating that federal action can extend healthcare coverage to populations otherwise uninsured at the state level. Universal healthcare access extends and unifies these existing architectures. Where Medicare covers one demographic, the VA covers one population, the Indian Health Service covers one population, EMTALA covers one circumstance, and ACA Medicaid expansion covers one income bracket, Pillar 4 extends federal healthcare administration to the entire American population. The administrative infrastructure exists in fragments. The platform consolidates those fragments into the unified universal access architecture. The existing programs have demonstrated works at federal scale for 60 years. The funding mechanism is a 4% employer/2% employee payroll contribution modeled on the Medicare hospital insurance tax, expanded to cover full medical care. The per capita target of $9,500 is set above Germany's $8,000, which already includes basic dental and basic vision per the German GKV, Gesetzliche Krankenversicherung, standard, and below Switzerland's $12,000. Coverage matches the German GKV scope, medical care, prescription drugs, with copays, basic dental, preventive and restorative, fillings, extractions, periodontal treatment, and basic vision, eye exams and eye disease treatment. Orthodontic and prescription correction are covered for children only. Cosmetic dentistry is excluded. Long-term care and hearing aids remain outside the scope as honest acknowledged gaps. For full substantiation, see the Healthcare Transition Detailed Plan and the Universal Healthcare Model. Pillar 5. Universal Childcare. Childcare is workforce infrastructure. When parents cannot work because care is unavailable or unaffordable, the entire economy loses the productivity those workers would have contributed. The cost falls disproportionately on women, whose workforce participation is materially affected by childcare availability and cost. Universal childcare addresses this through a Quebec model architecture. Parent copays capped at approximately $10 per day per child to $500 per year, the rest covered through public funding. The funding mechanism is a 0.8% employer/0.5% employee payroll contribution. The platform commits to covering approximately 12 million children at full build-out. A 12-year phase-in extended to 18 years to honestly reflect workforce capacity constraints in the childcare sector. Quebec's program produced an 8 to 10 percentage point increase in mothers' labor force participation. The platform expects similar directional effects in the United States. Universal childcare also operates as one of the platform's three indirect mechanisms reducing the gender pay gap. See gender pay gap and indirect mechanisms. For full substantiation, see the universal childcare model. Pillar 6. Universal mental health access. Mental health treatment is healthcare. The artificial separation of behavioral and physical health in the U.S. insurance system is a historical accident that produces treatment gaps, financial hardship, and worse outcomes for both individuals and the economy. Approximately 60 million Americans need mental health treatment in any given year. Approximately 30 million are currently untreated, primarily because access is constrained by cost, insurance coverage gaps, or workforce shortages. Universal mental health access provides voluntary access at no cost to all Americans, funded through a 0.5% employer/0.3% employee payroll contribution. Workforce capacity is adequate at approximately 40% utilization assumptions, with telehealth multiplying effective capacity by approximately 2x. The pillar's design emphasizes that distribution rather than raw supply is the core problem. Existing U.S. mental health workforce is sufficient, but is poorly distributed across regions and populations. For full substantiation, see the Universal Mental Health Access Substantiation Document and Universal Mental Health Model. Pillar 7. Civic Infrastructure. Civic infrastructure is the institutional capacity for self-governance. Energy grid modernization, universal broadband access, modernized civic engagement, civic technology, and physical civic infrastructure, water, transportation, public buildings, are all components. Each requires collective provision because no individual can construct it alone, and each operates on different time horizons than current consumption commitments. The civic infrastructure pillar was added in version 2.3 of the platform after the original three structural pillars were drafted as the first service pillar, in response to the observation that the platform was implicitly assuming functioning civic infrastructure without committing to its maintenance and modernization. Funding draws on sovereign fund disbursements at maturity rather than payroll contributions, on the principle that long horizon infrastructure investment is appropriately funded through investment returns rather than current year payroll. Substantiation documents cover each component: universal broadband, modernized civic engagement, civic technology, physical civic infrastructure, with associated mathematical models. The platform funds broadband and cellular infrastructure through federal ownership of the underlying fiber, with companies paying a federal infrastructure fee for using the federally owned infrastructure. The fee replaces the Universal Service Fund and consolidates state telecom taxes into a single federal mechanism. Annual fee target of approximately $34 billion per year recovers federal capital deployment, operations and maintenance, and future capacity reserve, The architecture follows the regulatory tradition of turnpike tolls, airport landing fees, and other use fees for public infrastructure.